was maybe to start with Eov, with the book of Job. And then the Gemara responds, well, you can't really do that because, you know, we don't really start with works of Puranus. Aschule Puranusa lo maschilinan, that we don't begin with works of Puranus. So the next suggestion the Gemara makes is, okay, let's begin with the book of Ruth. And the Gemara says, Ruth? How does that help? How is that any better than Job? How is that better than Eov? Puranus nami ika. And the Gemara says, okay, Puranus the Islay Achris. We don't deny it. Guilty is charged that it's a book about suffering, but there's redemption in the end. So we noted, we give a kind of a disclaimer, that the first few shirim would be a lot about suffering. Because Naomi can, in every sense of the term, hold the candle to Eov, maybe even more, the beginning of the work. And so what we discussed last week was this beginning, critical words, Vayihi bimei shvod ha-shoftim. It's not just a chronological statement, okay, it was during the time when the judges judged, but more to the point and more powerfully that these individuals were behaving characteristically of the times. Remember we spoke about the last verse in Sefer Shoftim, Bayamim ha-heim ein melech bi-Yisrael, ish ha-yashar be-inav yaseh. And everybody did what was good for him. And typically what we mean when we say that people do what's good for him is that that's basically a comment about self-interest. And self-interest very often can militate against the cultivation of a certain kind of idealism. And people act in their own self-interest, so that very often means that they're not acting in the interest of the tzibor, in the interest of the community. And that's exactly what we found at the beginning of the book of Ruth. Vayihi bimei shvod ha-shoftim, vayihi ra'av ba'aretz, vayelech ish, he's unnamed. He will be named later, but we made a big deal of the fact that at the beginning he's unnamed, because we said this ish is the every ish. He's the every man. Last week I said he was the Willy Low man. Right? He's a every man in Sefer Shoftim, ish hayashar beinav yaseh. And so we developed a perspective that gets a lot of credence in rabbinic interpretation to the book of Ruth, but I think that you can really see it very much through the simple reading that these were individuals who had the means to get out when the going got rough. And in any society, when a society falls on a time of economic hardship, and of course in an agrarian society that will often have to do with drought and famine, people of means are able to relocate. Why? They have sufficient assets, what we'd call today liquid assets, to be able to go and purchase land somewhere else and get themselves settled somewhere else. Whereas poor people, right, there's moving costs. To this very day there's moving costs, but then the moving costs are proportionally much greater. And so you have individuals, it's Elimelech and his two sons, Machlon and Chilion, who go, Lisidei Moav Lagur Sham, right? And Lagur Sham, we noted, we quoted from the Haggadah, Lo Yarad Yaakov Avinu Lishtakea B'Mitzrayim Ela Lagur Sham. Right, Yaakov said that he was not going with the intent of staying in the land of Egypt, but he was going for purposes of sticking out the famine. And Elimelech and his family go with those intentions, but we delineated last week how the text exquisitely demonstrates to us the process by which people become ensnared without even realizing it. Vayihi Yusham. And then even after the patriarch of the family dies, this is really a time for choosing, an expression that we used last week. And Naomi and her two sons make a very definitive choice. But the natural thing at that point still may have been to go back to the land of Israel. Remember, the sons are as yet unmarried. And instead, what do? And this is a Rubicon for them, there's no doubt about it. What do the sons do? They marry out, right? So they marry women from the surrounding Moabite tribes, which is not to say anything about the character of these women. In fact, we'll come to know them as very impressive people, perhaps more impressive than any of the naturally born Jews that we meet in the story, at least to a point. And they've decided that basically their goal would appear to be to assimilate. See, it's no longer about getting away from the famine. Now it's a different choice. Is what's my future? And Naomi, or whatever her feelings about it were not recorded, but at this point, her lot is sort of cast along with her sons, right? She's a widow, and these are going to be her grandchildren, right? Whatever emerges. And then tragedy strikes again, and then tragedy strikes again. And God smites Mahlon, and then Chilion. And the Navi uses the language, Vayamet Gam Oto. And one of the points that I'd like to bring out tonight is that the only other time we have this construct in the Chumash is in the famous story of Yehuda and Tamar, involving Yehuda's sons, Er and Onan, when they're not behaving in a particularly fraternal way. Especially Onan is supposed to marry Tamar after his older brother dies, and they're supposed to have children to carry on the legacy of his deceased brother, and he refuses to do it because the Torah says that Onan knew that it wouldn't really be his child, not in the full sense of the term. Biologically, yes. Genealogically, yes. But morally, spiritually, no. So the response is, you know, Vayeda Onan ki lo lo yihyeh hazara. He knew that it really wouldn't be his offspring, his child. It wouldn't count for those purposes. And therefore, Onan wasn't willing to have a child with Tamar. And the Torah says, Vayira b'nei Hashem asher asa vayamet gamuto. For failure to behave in a fraternal way. And the echoes and the shadows of the Yehuda and Tamar story, especially when we get to the last chapter, where we talk about Yibum and Chalitza and all of the process there in the fourth chapter, that shadow hangs very definitively over the entire book of Ruth. But here, it emerges for the first time, where you have these individuals who could have made a difference for Jews in their hometown of Beit Lechem, like we spoke about, people of means. And instead of sort of organizing social services on behalf of the Jewish people in Beit Lechem, they're wealthy, so they're able to relocate. And that's really what we discussed last week, is not in any way anomalous, but on the contrary, completely characteristic and symptomatic of a particular zeitgeist. That is, Bayamim Ahim in Melech b'Yisrael, there was no centralized leadership. Ish hayashar beinav yaseh, people tended to do what was their own in their own best interest. Dr. Gertler, go ahead. Yeah, clearly their names that are given. They can't really be their given names. But Mahlon from the language of machala, literally an ailment or a disease. Chilion from the language of klia, annihilation or elimination. So they're being given names, and that's going to be one of the themes of the book of Ruth, is who has a shame, who has a lasting name, who becomes anonymous, ploni almoni, and whose name is disgraced. And let's recall, because I don't want to give away, but remember the whole idea of the Yibum Chalitza narrative is that what is the individual called who won't stand up for his brother, right? Beit Chalutz Hanachal. His name is Mud, the Jewish people, because he won't build up his brother's family, the Kareshimo be Israel, Beit Chalutz Hanachal. This idea of what's your legacy, what's your name, choices that people make ultimately affect their position and how they're remembered historically. And that's really, to me, one of the most captivating aspects of the book of Ruth. It's a book that's self-consciously about legacy, about posterity, and how people are remembered, and the choices that people make, and the choices for which they're remembered. So that's what we discussed last week. And again, we noted that even, of course, as there was some sinful behavior, maybe a kind of a selfishness or an apathy on the part of Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion, we should also remember that, you know, as far as Naomi is concerned, there's just a very profound human tragedy that takes place here. And that this woman who, you know, started out with a family of her own, a husband and two children, and things were going well in the city of Beit Lechem, all of a sudden, you know, her entire life is disrupted and she sustained really horrific personal losses. So we should just be incredibly sensitive to the human tragedy, which is why the Gemara described the book of Ruth as primarily a book about poor Anas. Okay, so let's, moving on now in terms of the second source. This is where we had left off in the Psukim. So the Navi tells us as follows, and just to review one point, that the Talmud said that the authorship, and this makes perfect sense, of Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Ruth is one and the same, and that's Shmuel Hanavi. Shmuel wrote three books: Shoftim, Ruth, and Sefer Shmuel. V'takom hi v'chalotaha. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law get up, Vatashuv misidei Moab, and she begins to return from the plains of Moab. Kisha Moab istei Moab, she heard in the plains of Moab, Ki fakad Adonai et amo, that God had redeemed his people, latet lahem lachem, there will now be bread. Ki fakad Hashem et amo, of course, that echoes back to the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Remember, at the very end of Sefer Bereishit, Yosef makes the Jewish people take an oath, Pakod yivkod elokim etchem, God will redeem you one day, decades and centuries from now, eval yitem et atzmotai mizei etchem. So ki fakad Hashem et amo is a biblical construct that means that individuals for whom things have become extremely bleak, and now there's kind of like this glimmer of hope. Naomi senses that she's sort of gotten off track in life in a very significant way, and now she has to be able to return to her homeland, Ki fakad Hashem et amo. It's exactly the language, by the way, that the Torah uses in Sefer Shemot, Parshat Shemot, when Moshe first returns to the Jewish people, and he tells them that, of course, he had been sent on a mission by God to bring them out of the land of Egypt. And the Torah says, Vayishmu'am ki fakad Hashem et amo. It uses almost, not literally the same words. Vayamein ha'am, they believed, vayikdu vayishtachavu, and they prostrated themselves. So Naomi is having this kind of a response. Shmuel, the author of the Book of Ruth, is trying to evoke this image that she's beginning the process of emerging from assimilation. She's now headed back to the land of Israel. She's now headed back to the people of Israel. And by extension, she's headed back to the God of Israel. Okay, so all three of these things, land, people, and God, that's a direction in which Naomi should be headed. But and the Navi puts it in such a pithy way. From the place where she was. I thought we already knew that, right? Didn't the pasuk before say, Vatakom hi v'chaloteha v'tashuv misedei Moab? That they got up and they were returning from the fields of Moab. So what does the Navi mean when it says, Vatetzei min ha-makom asher haitashama? So I'd like to say is that this is not a geographic description alone, be redundant, but she's spiritually speaking trying to emerge from this period of assimilation, this period of alienation from her land, from her people, from her faith. But here's the dilemma. She now has a certain relationship with people who, of course, in their very being, in their very existence, tie her back to Moab. So the question is, how is she going to reconcile these stirrings of return that she senses with the fact that she has a relationship with two, as we'll see, very good people who in their very being bespeak not her connections to her original homeland, her original people, and her original faith, but represent everything about Moab. These are Moabite women. They're not pretending to be anything else. And they're accompanying her, at least at the beginning of this journey, and a conversation, and let me just put it this way, a tough conversation needs to be had, which is, what exactly is going to be taking place here? And that is an open question.
You mean the vav is a but?
What's that?
You mean the vav is a butter, however, right?
The ushtei chalotaha ima, exactly.
It's a butter, however.
Yeah. How is this going to happen? You know, there's going to have to be some discussion. But in the meantime, they're avoiding that discussion. They're just going. So Naomi breaks the ice. Lechna, go, shovna, return. Isha leveitima, go back to your mother's homes. Yas Hashem imachem chesed, kasher asitem im hametim, v'imadi. May God, we'll come back to the word that she uses for that. God do with you kindness as you did with the dead, meaning my sons, your husbands, we've all suffered here, and with me. Yitena Hashem lachem, may God give you generously. Umitzena minucha, may you find minucha, literally respite, But there's a deeper connotation here. Minucha means some kind of degree of serenity or tranquility, and there's even a marital connotation to this, which is that you shouldn't be unsettled. You should be able to find some sense of peace and being settled in the context of a family. Right now, they have no attachments, and of course, they're going to need, and she's concerned for their welfare, to be able to build up for themselves. Yitein Hashem lachem umitzena minucha isha beit isha, right? That you should be able to find husbands for yourselves. Vatishak lahen, and she kisses them. Vatisena kolan vativkena. And they all lift up their voices, and they cry extensively. Vatomar nala, and they say to her, ki itach nashuv la'ameich. We'll return with you to your nation. Before we go on, it's important just to consider how meaningful and how powerful a statement this is on the part of the two daughters-in-law. Have they ever been to Judea? Presumably not. Do they have prospects there? Presumably not. Do they have any connections there? Surely not. And Naomi had just finished saying to them, go back to your families. And here's where I want to bring in the word that she used. She said, Yas Hashem imachem chased. See, when Jews and non-Jews are speaking about God in Tanakh, they always talk in terms of Elohim, the God of the world, generic term for a deity. Monotheistic term, God. Right. Hashem, Yod, then Hey, then Vav, then Hey, is the God of the Jews. So when Naomi says, Yas Hashem Imachem Chesed, surely she's giving them a blessing that God should be generous with them, but she's also sending them a message, which is, I'm re-identifying with my Jewish faith. And that means that our paths are going to diverge. And their response is, well, no. Ki itach, with you, nashuv la'ameich. We can't say we know very much about your God, and we're not going to pretend to, but we are attached to you as a person. And through you, we'll return to your people. And we'll see what that takes us. So this kind of deep devotion and a loyalty and a commitment here, which tells you a great deal about the character of the individuals involved. Right? I mean, let's not forget that we're talking about women from Moab. Moab, of course, they're the descendants of Lot. And one of the most important moments in all of Sefer Bereishit is when Lot appeared to be Avram's heir, right? Just before Avram has Ishmael, just before Yitzhak arrives on the scene. And Lot is functionally speaking, Avram's son. I mean, it's his nephew, but Avram's brother is dead, so it's Avram's adopted son, more or less. Right? And what happens? And things don't work out, so all too soon, you know, he pared na me'alai, Avram says, that we have to separate. And the Torah tells us about Yisalot etina, vayar kol kikar yardenti, chulam ashkat. He sees all the financial opportunities for himself in the Sodom area, and he seizes them, right? And this man who had given him so much, who had become the surrogate father, leaves behind. Right? I mean, that's in the background here, of separation, and yet Ruth and Orpah are anything but, right? And even though, right, they literally have no prospects whatsoever in the context of Judea, what Naomi's own prospects are, let's call them uncertain, to be generous. We'll see just how bleak they are next week and the week after that. But the point of the matter is that they're saying, we're throwing caution to the wind because we're devoted to you. Kitach nashuv le'ameich. It's the anti-love. Right? We're not operating out of self-interest. We're operating out of a sense of idealism or fidelity to you. But let's put it in the sharpest terms we can, they're operating in every way that the Jews don't operate and don't act in Sefer Shoftim. Bayamim ha'hem ein melech b'Yisrael, yishe yashar b'nav yaseh. Everybody made a cheshbon and everybody made a calculation. What's going to be good for me? How am I going to end up ahead through this deal? And what Rud and Orpah are reflecting is just the opposite. Right? Instead of considering themselves, all they're worried about is their mother-in-law, who sustained a triple tragedy, her husband and her two sons, and they don't want to leave her alone. Now, do they know anything about this Hashem that she speaks about? Of course not. Do they know anything about Judea or Beit Lechem? No. But it's loyalty, and it's commitment, and there's something that we can deeply admire about that, both on the part of Rut and Orpah. And Naomi, for her part, is trying very hard to talk reason into them. Thing, this does not make sense for you. But Tomer Naomi, Shovna v'notai, says, I consider you my own daughters also. This isn't only difficult for you. It's very, very difficult for me as well. See, originally she says, each of you go back to Beit Imad, go back to your own mother's house. Then what does she sort of come out with? She says, I know that, and you know that I'm your mother. Exactly, Eva. But as your mother, I'm telling you, this is not good for you. I want you to have a future. Vatomer Naomi, shov na v'notai, lama telach naimi. It doesn't mean why, it means how can you go with me? Ha'od livanim b'me'ai v'ayu lachem la'anashim. You have no future with me. Your marriage prospects are zero. Why? Because if I could have more children, okay, I'd be happy to marry off these young men to you. But, right, first of all, this isn't going to work out chronologically, and I'm too old for that as it is. Shov na v'notai, my daughters, I'm pleading with you, leichna, go back. Ki zakanti miyot le'ish. I'm not having any more children. Ki amarti yesh li tikva. Even if I would say that there was some hope for me, gam hayiti halayla le'ish v'gam yelati banim, if I'm going to have children tomorrow, halahein tisaberna asher yigdalu. Are you going to wait around for over a decade? Halahein te'agena, will you become agunot, literally chained for them? Mevilti ayod li'ish al binotai. Third time, my daughters, kimar li ma'od mikem. Extremely bitter, and this will only add, ki atzavi yad Hashem, my God, the God of the Jews, has punished me. Vatisena kolan, and they lift up their voices, vativkena od, they cry even more. Vatishak Orpala Chamota, and Orpah kisses her mother-in-law. Virut Davkaba. First, let's deal with Orpah. Okay, you know, some midrashic literature, Orpah gets a bad name. You know, she abandoned Naomi. I think the simple reading of the text is anything but. Orpah literally had to be forced, essentially, by Naomi back to Moab. And the very fact that she was even willing to consider staying with her mother-in-law tells you a great deal about her character and about her loyalty to her mother-in-law and her willingness to think very seriously and to be willing to essentially sacrifice her own future, right? We don't know anything about, you know, magical mysteries and miracles that are going to happen later on in the book. You have to read the book in order, you know? And Orpah's willingness to go along with this, to the extent that she was, a remarkable testament to her character. And you can just, that's why the Navi keeps on emphasizing the tears and the crying, how painful this is for her to separate from her mother-in-law. And yet, of course, in comparison to Ruth, who stays, it's easy to see Orpah as somehow flawed. I'd like to strongly argue against that reading. What makes Ruth extraordinary and beyond is that Orpah does not do anything bad. Orpah is very devoted, very concerned, very conscientious, very committed, and yet when Naomi tells her, you know, you have to think pragmatically, you have to be realistic about this, you have to understand what your prospects are and what you'd be getting yourself into, then she reacts accordingly. What I'd like to suggest is that Ruth Dafka behaves irrationally. You know, it's interesting, the very word chesed, both the Ibn Ezra and the Rambam make this point, the word chesed, which is exactly what Ruth is showing, according to these two very important commentaries, means to act in a way that's extreme.
There's one time in Sefer Vayikra where the Torah uses chesed to describe an act of sexual immorality. Everyone says, what does this have to do with chesed? And again, even Ezra there and others comment, chesed just means an extreme behavior. We use it 95% of the time in the context of extreme generosity. But sometimes it could mean extremely insidious behavior. But the idea is that it's behavior that doesn't conform to a norm. So Ruth's chesed is an overwhelming, extreme, and completely self-negating act of altruism on behalf of her bereft mother-in-law. And the Navi's use of the term virut davkava is something I want to explore. Very specific and rare instances in Tanakh, we have the utilization of this term. First, Alkeni Azovisha Davivet Imo v'davak b'ishto. It bespeaks the kind of intimacy of a marital relationship. When the Torah wants to describe what a person should aspire to in terms of relationship with God, it says uvo tidbak, or uvo tidbakun, that we should aspire, obviously in a non-literal sense, to try our best to cleave to God, virut av kaba. In the tochacha, when the Torah wants to describe just how bad it's going to get, the Torah says that all of these makot will be midavek bachem, will literally cleave unto you. It bespeaks not the idea that, you know, Ruth was hanging around with her, but like in modern Hebrew, the term devek means glue. She could not separate herself from her mother-in-law. This was something where her heart was leading her head. And that's important to recognize, is that the bonding that's going on here is nothing less than a mother-daughter bond. That's why, of course, you know, Naomi used the terms binotai, three successive psukim. She feels that these are her daughters. And I'd like to really conclude by suggesting two further thoughts. Now, where did this relationship come from? Obviously, the text is sparse. We don't know very much about how it was that Naomi came to be so close with her two daughters, with Orpah and in particular with Ruth. But anybody have a suggestion? Where does it come from? The Navi doesn't describe it. We really don't know definitively, but if you had to speculate, Eva.
If a mother loves her sons, the sons pick wives, and if good fortune, they had a good relationship, then we don't know how the boys died, but if the wives really were nurturing to the husbands before they died, that would increase their relationship with the mother-in-law when she would see how good the wives were to her sons.
And there is an allusion to that. So Eva's absolutely correct, where it says, Yas Hashem Imachem Chesed, God should do kindness with you, Kasher Asitem Im Hametim V'imadi, just as you had done with my sons. I saw the way that you cared for them, that you were devoted to them. So I think Eva raises a very important point. I think this is sort of implicit in what Eva's saying as well. The way that I'm going to formulate it is a sense of shared tragedy. That sometimes shared tragedy can drive people apart. Sometimes shared tragedy can really bring people closer together, because there are very few people in the world who can understand what these losses meant to Naomi, of course, and here are the only two people who can understand and appreciate that. Yeah, Herb, please.
I'd like to take a viewpoint of the two women, only the effect of the husband on the women to be married, these two strangers. There's already an identification with them and what their beliefs have been, as opposed to their
opinion. You know, it's a really interesting question. Is to what extent was it a compromise on both of their parts? To what extent was it Machon and Chilion, let's call them that because that's how the text refers to them, basically saying, we're willing to conform to Moavi society? To what extent was it Rud and Orpah saying, we're willing to, you know, have a Christmas tree and a Hanukkah bush? That's a really interesting question. But the willingness to be open to that is something that I think that tells you a lot about that. Yeah, Dr. Gertler.
That resource, that financial resource.
Yeah, okay, so maybe that's a part of it. Now, of course, as we know, the expression goes, somebody who marries for money pays for it their entire lives, right? The idea that, it's not doing very much for them now,
And throughout the next few chapters, as we discuss the utter poverty, the dire conditions in which Ruth finds herself, is something that's important as well. I just wanted to conclude for tonight with one final thought, because I think it's extremely important, especially in light of Herb's very incisive comments, which is, here you have these two women that did not have a problem marrying people from Judea. Now, I'm not claiming that they were the most observant people in the world or whatever it was. Obviously, they were willing to marry out of their faith. So I'm not saying that it was a theological issue for them, but simply at the level of tribalism or xenophobia, you're talking about people who didn't have a problem marrying people from the other side of the River Jordan, their aspiration, of course, was to build a life together, and tragically, it doesn't work out. Now, what Naomi is signaling very strongly to her daughters-in-law by telling them, you have to go home. You have no future with me. You're saying, ki itach nashuv lameich, that we're going to return with you to your nation. What Naomi is signaling to her daughters-in-law is, whatever graciousness, whatever generosity, whatever largesse of spirit you showed my family, don't expect. She essentially tells them the only possible way that either of them could expect to remarry in the land of Israel is if Naomi herself were to bear sons, which is not a biological possibility. So she's warning them, don't expect society to reflect your goodness and your graciousness in this regard. On the contrary, people are going to, she seems to be warning them, treat you with great reserve, I'm putting it generously, with outright denigration and prejudice. So Rabbi Yehuda famously says, "Amoni v'lo amonit, Moavi v'lo Moavit." And the Chachamim say, "Well, it's because they were punished for specific sins, and we'll talk about that and what the specific sins were." And somehow that shouldn't apply to the women. It's actually a dispute. It's a machlokas between the minority view, which is that it includes Ammonite and Moabite women, and the majority view is that it would not be to the exclusion of Ammonite and Moabite women that they would be able to marry in. But either way, even one circumvents the legal issue, the issue of prejudice and xenophobia is something we're going to see come up constantly throughout the rest of the work. So again, I think Naomi, in her own way, acting as a mother would, is trying to look out for and protect these young women, and trying to explain that their generosity of spirit is not necessarily going to be reciprocated by the nation that they're going to encounter. And yes, ki itach nashuv l'ameich, a very altruistic and idealistic sentiment, but she's trying to indicate as best as she possibly can that her own society is not going to work that way. And they'll be at the margins of society at best. And if so, does this really make sense for them? And here we come to the second great moment, or the third, excuse me, great moment for choosing. See, the first moment for choosing is there's a famine. And the Ish and his family, the Ish we come to know as Elimelech, they decide to leave. Choice one. Elimelech dies. The widow and the two sons decide to stay in Moab, marry Moabite women. Choice two. Now we have choice number three, which is Naomi has spelled it out. If they come back with her, they're sacrificing their own future. They have very little, if anything, to look forward to on a personal basis. And here we have the third moment for choosing. But this is different than the first two. Insofar as in the first two, all the people who were choosing went in the same direction.
Right, Elimelech and the family leave Judea and go to Moab. Choice number two, Naomi and the two sons, they stay in Moab, a choice. But here, at this third moment for choosing, Orpah heads home, Berut Davkaba. Now, again, I want to conclude with this line, leave it in our minds for a week from tonight. Ruth's cleaving to her mother-in-law is not, at its core, a rational act. And the Navi does not portray it as a rational act. Orpah, who has great love for her mother-in-law, who she relates to as a mother, and whom Naomi in return relates to as a daughter, in the end is compelled to act rationally, out of rational self-interest, to go back to Moab. When the Navi describes Ruth's decision to stay with Naomi, it's simply Virut Davkava. She cleaved to her. She simply couldn't detach herself. Maybe in her own mind she would have told you that the right thing to do would be to go home. But she was unable to do so. Viscerally unable to do so. It's kind of a deep and profound detachment. And like I say, it's not a rational moment, but it's a beautiful moment. It's one of the most beautiful moments that we have in Tanakh. And it's the perfect antidote, and this we're going to try to develop and cultivate this particular perspective to what Vayehi Bimei Shvod HaShoftim is all about. Right? Because as the pasuk goes, that we continue to reiterate, there was no king in Israel, Bayamim Ahem in Melech Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Ish Hayashar Be'inav Yaseh. It's a calculated choice. It's a society that calculates self-interest. What's going to be best for me in the end? Sometimes you can predict it, sometimes you can't predict it. There are a lot of unknowns in life. Everybody remembers Rumsfeld's famous line, the known knowns, the known unknowns, the unknown knowns, whatever it is. You can't predict everything, but insofar as the eye can see, Ish Hayashar Be'inav Yaseh. I'm not saying that Ruth is a foolish person, far from that. But in terms of where her decision is coming from, it's not coming from Isha, in this case, Isha Hayashar Be'inav Ta'aseh. Or Be'inav Ta'aseh. This is not a calculated choice that it's all going to work out, and let me tell you reasons A, B, C, D, and E, what my plan is. There's no plan. It's a decision that doesn't come from an intellectual evaluation. It comes from a deep and visceral attachment to a person. And that's an antidote to some of the very deep cynicism of Sefer Shoftim, of Ish HaYashar Be'inav Yaseh. I do what's good for me. Don't bother me with high-minded values. And in that way, this outsider, somebody from outside of Jewish society, is going to be able to come in. And even though she's not in the book of Shoftim itself, right? This is a companion work, right? Yibi Mei Shvod HaShoftim. And in a society where the Elimelechs and the Machlons and the Chilions were making choices based on self-interest, based on these kinds of calculations, Ruth becomes the antidote to all of them. Where her motivations are not based on self-interest, it's not rational calculation. There's an emotional loyalty, there's love, there's commitment, virut davkaba, and Ruth simply couldn't act any differently, even had she wished to act differently. And Shmuel HaNavi, in writing about this, is telling us that there's still a spark, there's a glimmer of humanity out there, but it's not actually coming from within the Jewish people. It's going to have to be reintroduced to the Jewish people from the outside. That's really going to be at the core of what the book of Ruth is all about, is how spiritually desiccated Jewish society has become, and how this woman from Moab is going to come and re-inject an element of humanity, of kindness, of consideration, of morality into Jewish society. And we're going to see over the course of our study of this book how Ruth's behavior ultimately leads to the transformation or the reactivation of Jewish society. Jewish society finally able to rediscover its moral roots. It's going to take somebody from the outside it's going to take root, Hamo Aviyah. So we're going to pick it up there next week with the so-called conversion of Ruth. We're going to read those passages together and try to understand those critical moments where Ruth and Naomi are understanding for the first time that maybe their future could be together in the land of Yehuda, in the land of Judea.